To our lecture on Chapter 3, Writing Simple Programs for the Google App Engine book. This chapter is sort of these slides and this audio, copyright Creative Commons attribution, of course. So this is the scope of the course: technologies in web browsers, technologies of the internet, and then technologies in the server. And now we're moving into the code in the server. And so when we do our request response cycle, what's wrong with my scribbler? Thought I had that already started. Open. So when we do our request response cycle, part of the time that request response cycle spends its time in the server. Now, in the oversimplified view of the request response cycle, we basically say, oh, and then a file comes back. And the answer is not really. Anything that that server wants to produce comes back. One of the things that it can produce is just take a contents of a file, like an HTML file or a JPG file, and spew it out as the response. And that's common and that's normal, but in reality, that the moment it's in that server, software is what's really receiving that request. And that when it's sending a file out, that software just happens to be deciding to open a file and read it and stream the contents back out. What we're going to do now for the rest of this course is we're going to actually write the software that intercepts those requests. And so we're going to switch away from just static files and static content, but be able to generate dynamic content, different content, based on what's in a database perhaps, or based on sort of a session where you're sort of guessing a series of numbers and getting closer and closer in the guessing. So we have to have a programming language inside. Now, Python is not the most popular programming language in servers. We use it in SI539 because it's fun and easy to learn, and it's a good way to learn and not get too stuck in the details of the language. SI572 teaches you PHP. PHP is a far more commonly used programming language for the web. And so the idea is we teach you sort of basic stuff, give you the whole view of it, and then 572 we go much deeper. But in 572, you kind of have to have your game already on in 572 because it goes so quickly. So in the server, Python runs and produces some kind of output, and the output comes back to the browser, and then that HTML and CSS and whatever that comes back from the server is what causes the page to be displayed. And so in this lecture, in 3 short hours, we are going to teach you how to program. Actually, no, hopefully you know somewhat how to program. In this, especially if you're in 502 at the same time, this will sort of seem familiar, but what we're really doing is we're taking 5 weeks of 502 and compressing it down to 3 hours. So we will go from beginning to end of Python. Now, how can I do that in 539? Well, partly I hope you've taken 502. Partly, I hope you've done some programming before, but I'm also throwing away everything that's not essential for this class. There's a lot more to Python than what's in this lecture. This chapter in this lecture is only the stuff that I consider essential for the rest of this class. And there's lots and lots of Python, like opening and closing files, that we're not going to really play with. So, within the web server, we are getting these requests from lots of web browsers, and we are like the catcher in a baseball team where we are boom, and we got to deal with something coming in, and it just keeps coming, and we got to react to it. And of course, we don't want to do this by hand. We want to generate all this stuff dynamically, and so we have to write a program to sort of respond the way we want to respond to each of these requests. So you can think of this as sort of the classic telephone operator. So in a sense, this is a continuation of the notion that we and our programs are somehow embedded in the computer answering the question, what next? In a kind of a classic programming environment, we are writing code and the CPU is central processing unit is simply executing our code, and we just are feeding it as fast as we can by pre-writing the code and handing it to the computer, so it's actually coming right out of the main memory of the computer rather than us having to type it one statement at a time. So there are several different patterns for programs. One is a sequential set of steps. The other is some steps are conditional that may or may not be executed. Sometimes a step or a group of steps is repeated over and over. Sometimes we store a set of steps to be reused over and over in several places throughout the programs. Now, the interesting thing is that this looping, repeating, and store and reuse in some ways is not as heavily used in web applications. Web applications look a little bit different than, say, your typical application that reads a file and computes an average. That file has a certain canonical plot line, as it were. Something happens here, something happens in the middle, something happens at the end. Web programs tend to not have as much looping. And the reason is the request response cycle itself is the loop. The browser just keeps coming at you and asking over and over. So most web programs sort of receive something, sort of burn through some almost often sequential code, and then send something back. I'm not saying there's no loops involved and there's no functions involved. What I'm saying is that the general pattern of a classic sort of command line program or a program that's doing data analysis is open file, read each line and do something, finish. It's not. In web programming, it's here comes a request, what am I supposed to do? Send something back. Oops, here comes another request, what am I supposed to do? Send something back. So we tend to have this straight line code pattern rather than loops as the core of what we're doing. The loop is really the browsers doing the loop for us, the many browsers that we're dealing with. So if we look at a typical recipe, it shows some of these things. Add 300 grams of flour, add 100 milliliters of milk, add an egg. If the altitude is greater than 2,000 feet, add a second egg, add 30 grams of salt. While there are too many lumps, beat the mixture with a fork. That's kind of a loop, round and round and round. And then open and add the flavor packet. That's kind of, well, we didn't invent the flavor packet. The flavor packet came inside the box and somebody else figured out what the flavor packet was and we're just reusing the flavor packet. Now, how we express this can be very different, right? If we make a mistake in our syntax and sort of say if the altitude is greater than 200, we do all this red stuff, well, then if the altitude is below 200, we're just going to end up with a mess, right? We're not going to actually end up with biscuits. So the syntax that we use in creating a recipe is much like the syntax that we use in creating a program. And so it's very important to be precise and to make sense. So I'll take the example I use in SI 502 of elevators in Europe in particular, since I'll be in Amsterdam this time next week. Well, not this time next week, but I'll be back from Amsterdam this time next week. So elevators in Europe start at zero for the first floor, and elevators in the United States start at one. Now, it'd be interesting to see if children's mathematical scores are somehow benefited by this notion of being emphasized that the beginning of the number system is zero and that negative numbers exist, right? From the very moment you walk into your first hotel, you're emphasized the existence of zero, which is an important concept for young people in mathematics, and the existence of negative numbers and the symmetry between positive and negative numbers, right? Just think how much learning goes on in elevators in Europe that's not going on in elevators in the United States of America. So here is a piece of software that shows the input, processing, and output. And to some degree, it's kind of like a web page processing in that the input's coming from the outside world. We are in the server doing some work. And then some output that we're producing is the valuable thing that we're returning to the world. So we see this pattern over and over when we're programming on the web. So this is a really trivial program that converts US floor numbers to European floor numbers. And so it runs sequentially. The first thing that it does is asks us for the US floor number. We're using the input, which is, it does some conversion. And so it converts it to an integer for us. And so that gives us a number 2. And then we subtract 1 and create the worldwide floor. And then we print out the worldwide floor. So we take some input from the user, we do some computation with variables and other kind of groovy stuff, and then we produce some output. And so the output comes out Our input is what we type and feed the program. But again, this is oversimplified, but it is a good approximation for how your program will perceive the request response cycle. So, sequential steps in Python are simply steps that we put into a file one after another. And so in this step, I'm saying x equals 1. So I'm taking and allocating the variable called x and sticking the number 1 in it. Then I'm printing it out, so out comes the number 1. Then I am, in this assignment statement, I am looking up the old value of x, adding 1 to it, and putting it back into x. And so 2 ends up in x. The next statement is print 2. So these, it's like do this, then fall through, and then do this, and then do this, and do this. So when in doubt, when things are lined up in the exact same column, one line after another, they just execute in sequence from the beginning to the end. So the CPU or Python says, what next? What next? What next? What next? So it's always asking the question, what should I do next? And so our job as we write programs is to communicate to Python what we would like to be done next. Conditional steps in Python are indicated by the keyword if, and the line ends in a colon, and the conditional code is indented. So this line here, print smaller, may or may not be executed. It will only be executed if this x is less than 10 is true. So this part here is like asking a question. Question. Is this true or not? If it is true, we're going to do this. In this case, if x is greater than 20, we're going to do this. But in general, the overarching sort of pattern is one of sequence. So the lines execute sequentially, and this executes in the right sequence. The difference is it may not execute at all, and that's the conditional part about it. And so if we run this code sequentially, x is 5. If x is less than 10, that's true, so we dive into the little indented part and execute this sequentially, print smaller, and out comes smaller. Then we de-indent, and the next thing it does sequentially is checks this if. Is x greater than 20? Well, since x is 5, that's false, and so this code, it says if it's not there, at least, you know, in this, so that print bigger doesn't happen, it just skips that line because this is false. So there's the conditional part. Python may or may not execute that code. I think this syntax is pretty expressive, pretty reasonable, but if you think of it more in terms of these diagrams, these if tests are like forks in the road. They're choices that get made, and based on the true or falseness of the question that's being asked, you're going to pick one of the two exit points. If it's true, you're going to go down this road, and if it's false, you're going to go down this road. Now, in the true case, you run the conditional code, and then you rejoin the road, and you continue. So this is exactly the same as if it's true, you run the code and continue. If it's false, in the case of false, you just skip it. So it's a bypass. And so all the if is saying is, do we go into here, or do we go right past it? Repeated steps are very similar. They're kind of look like ifs. The difference is instead of if, we say while. So while says, check this, it's still a question. This part here is still a question that's being asked. And it ends in a colon, and there's an indented little indented block here. There's a little indented block. And what this basically says is, come in here, check to see if this is true. If it's true, execute the little block. And then, unlike the if, it goes back up and checks again. And if it's still true, it executes it again. And then it goes back up. And if it's still true, it executes it again. And if it's still true, it executes it again. And again and again and again and again, until it becomes false, and then it leaves. Now, if it turns out that it's false right away, it functions like an if and skips right over top of it. But in this case, n starts to be out at 5, n greater than 0 is true, so it comes in and says 5. Prints 5, then subtracts 1, so n becomes 4, goes back up, prints 4, subtracts it to 3, and then prints out 2, then prints out 1. So it's printing out 1 now. Then it subtracts 1 from n, and n becomes 0, and then it comes up, and it asks the question, is n greater than 0? And now n is not greater than 0 because we've changed it, and so we leave. Probably easier to see here. It checks the question, and if it's not true, it skips completely. But in this case, n is greater than true when we first start. So it runs once, checks n again, runs twice, 3, 4, 5. Now n is 0, and so it comes out and leaves. Okay? And so a while statement in Python is like an if statement, except it keeps going until the logical test becomes false. Store and reused is something that we won't do much here. I'll give you some code, and there's some functions that you will use. You won't build a lot yourself. So the pattern, it's more important to understand it than to sort of imagine how you might choose to use it. I'll kind of tell you when it's time to use it. But the idea is that there's another keyword called def, which stands for defined function. And you give it a function name, followed by an optional set of parameters, and then an indented block. And when the def happens, it actually doesn't run the code. It skips it. It remembers it. And it makes this little place, magically, somewhere in the computer's memory. It names it hello because that's the name you chose. It's kind of like a variable, except with parentheses, it's a function. It's a variable-like thing that contains code. And then later in the program, after we define this thing called hello, we can invoke this thing called hello. And it says, oh, there we go, run these lines of code. So it remembered them at this point. At this point in the program, it's remembered them, but it hasn't run them. At this point in the program, it's running them, and so out comes hello and fun. Then zip comes out, and then we can, the reuse part is we can call hello as many times as we want, and we don't have to keep retyping the code over and over again. So the first purpose of these things is to create some bit of code that we're going to use many times and not have to paste the same thing over and over. Programmers generally hate doing the same thing over and over. It's not so bad in the beginning, but then what if you want to change something and then you got to go find the 45 places that you put identically cloned code, and it's really frustrating. So you go to the one place that you put it and you change it. So that's one of the primary use cases of store and reuse and functions and defined function, is so that you don't say the same thing over and over and over again. So now I'm going back to talk about sort of how the request response cycle works and how we run programs inside of App Engine. So forms are the elements inside of HTML that allow us to enter data, right? If all we could do in HTML, and frankly in the earliest days of HTML, all you could really do is connect link to link to link to link to link, which means that you could never write a UPS package tracking system if you couldn't enter data into the web. And so as a matter of fact, in the earliest days of the web in 90, 91, 92, 93, in 90, we were all using a protocol called Gopher. And you can go look at some really old Gopher stuff, and it looks totally like, wow, they survived this. We thought it was the coolest thing ever back in 1991. And so lots of people were using Gopher in 90 and 91. And, you know, the web was invented in 1990 as well. It just wasn't very popular until 93, 94. And I have a really good history of seeing a new technology and making a completely incorrect assessment of it. And so when I first saw the web, I'm like, Gopher kicks its butt. The web is not going to go anywhere. It's kind of pointless. Gopher is pretty awesome. And all the web is kind of like, you know, you got more links on a page. And so I kind of poo-pooed the web for probably the first 6 months of my awareness of the web. I thought it was no big deal. And then I saw the FedEx.com website where you could put a FedEx tracking number in and hit the submit button. And then I said, this web thing's going to go and be really awesome at this point because it allows us to write software on the web, not just use content. So Gopher was all about content, very little interactivity. It was all about surfing and finding and clicking on content. And the web in the earliest of days was about finding and clicking on content that is of limited value. When we can't give it any input, it's kind of a flat, relatively dead space. You can write, it's like the world. Web originally was a great big wiki. Wikis are cool, I'm not against wikis. It's just, that's not what you're all doing right now on your thing. You're actually using Facebook, which actually takes your input and stores it somewhere. So the essence of input on the web is what forms are all about. So in a later lecture, we'll understand how to construct forms, and we'll understand how the data comes in through forms, we'll understand all that. But for now, let's just have some magic. This is a black magic black box, right? So imagine that at some point, we have this game running on a web server, and it gives us a place to enter a number, and the program has some output, and we're going to enter a guess, 25, and then we're going to press the submit button. And somehow, through magic, your little Python program has started up, and it has this variable guess. Somehow that number 25 is in the variable guess. We'll talk and we'll understand that later, but for now let's pretend that part's magic. Somehow it's you have a program, it's sitting in the somewhere in a server on the web, and it's started and you have been handed this particular user's guess. Now your job is to write some code to properly process the guess. So the answer to the question, of course, is 42. We are going to have a series of if statements. If guess is less than answer, print your guess is too low. If guess is equal to the answer, print congratulations. If guess is greater than answer, print your guess is too high. So the output of this program then becomes the new screen that they see, right? So apparently the last time I guessed 20, and it says my guess is too low. And then I go in, I guess 25, and it'll say your guess is too low again. So the request response cycle is, in this case, some data is being given to our program and we have to react to that data and produce a new web page. And again, it won't be magic for long, but for now, just imagine that this number 25 somehow makes it into this variable guess. Okay? So, we have conditional code like if then else, where, you know, if guess is answer, if that's true, we do this. And if it's false, we skip the first part and we do the second part. So that's an if then else, a common use of Python. An important part of any programming language is the ability to nest things. And so in Python, space is significant. We can have an if-then-else here, and if it's true, this executes, and then it skips all this, right? Because it skips to whatever the next line is that lines up with that else. There happens to be an if-then-else inside of here. If, on the other hand, this is false, it skips the first part and then runs this bit. It thinks of this bit here as a block, and if the guess is less than answer, and that's true, then it runs this, and then skips this. If guess is not equal to answer, then it comes in here. If guess is not less than answer, it skips this, and runs this, and then continues on at the end. This totally indented if-then-else, this if-then-else right here, that's indented, is called nested. It's nested within that else, okay? It at the high level on this outer if, it's all skipped, but once you sort of fall into this code, it's its own if-then-else. And so one of the things as you write programs is you kind of get used to drawing these mental squares around blocks of code. That block of code is indented, and it's part of that first else. So seeing these little squares is an important part of parsing software. So I'm not sure this is actually a better way to describe it, but it is accurate. I mean, once you start just seeing these things, it's natural, but if you really have to look at them from a very procedural sort of step-by-step, this first if is going to make a choice one way or the other, and if it's true, it runs this little block here and then skips the entire other block. If it's false, then it drops into the second block, and then it makes its own if-then-else choice and then runs together. Oops. And the else-if is another way to do this same thing, because it is common for us to have in a series of evaluations that we're going to do. And the syntax here is we have an elif, which is a contraction for else-if that lines up with the if and the else. And the way it's processed is the first if, this one here, is evaluated. If it's true, it runs that indented code, which is this indented code right here. And then it skips the rest of them. So the key to this structure is as soon as one of these is successfully executed, it leaves the entire if. So only one of the three blocks is going to be executed. Whichever one hits true first, it doesn't look at the rest of them. So if this is true and this is true, the only one that will run is the first one. So variables are an important part of programming as well. So variables are something that we as the programmer invent. They're named locations in the computer's memory. We use variables to store values that we're going to use later in the program. In the previous example, I used the input guess as a variable, and I used the answer 42 as a variable. In this little floor converting application, we have two variables. One is a variable called the US floor, and the other is called the worldwide floor. And I can make these things up, USF, and the only thing that matters is that they correspond, because if these lines don't exist, if we pretend they don't exist here, all this first line says is read a number off of input and store it in the variable USF for later. Okay? Just store it for later. Now, later happens to be one line later, and then we're going to pull it back out. So what's the purpose of this variable? Well, it's so that I can keep my life kind of simple. I'm just kind of storing this number here. I could actually, if I really wanted to, I could take this whole input statement and I could stick it right here. I could actually say input blah, 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 minus one, and it would still work. So the variable for me is just to make it so I can break this into two statements so that I don't have cognitive overload when I'm trying to parse this stuff. And similarly, WF, again, I picked it, and its only purpose is to make it so that these two things can be two statements. I could actually combine this whole mess together as one big ugly statement if I didn't use variables. Let me go ahead and do that. Yikes, now what are you doing? Hang on. So in this particular situation, I am creating this USS variable for the sole purpose of using it exactly one statement later. And then I'm creating this WF variable for the exact purpose of using it one statement later. I frankly could have written this program in one long line. I could say, non-US floor number is, comma, input, enter the US floor number, minus one. I could have put that all on the same line. I only introduced the variables for my own sort of cognitive simplicity and for so that I could better explain to you, or if you were a fellow programmer later that would just try to read my code and understand what I'm doing, it's harder to read this. They're doing the exact same thing, but I introduced these variables to make it clearer what's going on, that there are kind of three steps. This second program would function just as well. And there's a common mistake that beginning programmers want to do, and that is they think it's really sophisticated to show off how they can make use of statements like this last one, and they work, and they're showing off that you kind of understand the order of evaluations and the fact that functions happen before subtractions. It's really kind of awesome, and then the print happens afterwards, and that will do exactly the right thing for you. And you're sort of showing off, but you're kind of making it hard for the next programmer to understand what it is that you're accomplishing. So Python's variable names, they must start with a letter or an underscore and consists of letters, numbers, or underscores. So these are examples of good variables. These are example of bad variables, like value minus 7. Dash can't be part of a variable name because Python wants to think of that as a subtraction. And case matters. So most people just create most variables as lowercase, rarely using a few variables as uppercase. Some languages, not Python, tend to like mixed case, where you might, if you have a variable that's got a couple of words in it, you tend to uppercase the first letter of each word, but that's not done in Python. So it's a good idea to choose variables wisely. Python really doesn't care as long as your variables are consistent and you use them the proper way after you define them. So here I create a variable called USF and I just use it. And here I create a variable called WF. For me, that stands for US, United States floor and worldwide floor. And so non-mnemonic variables are just things that don't bring to mind any meaningful concept. They're perfectly legitimate and they're syntactically correct. But the mnemonic variables are things like count and lines and words and USF and WF that somehow act as a trigger in our memory. So here is the two versions of this same Python program. One uses mnemonic variable names in the form of US floor, and the other one's called world floor. But Python would be perfectly satisfied with the second one, where I call the first variable DSJDKJDS, as long as these two things corresponded, and then this variable could easily just be XSJKJDS, as long as these two things corresponded. Now, as programmers, if I'm looking at your code and I'm trying to see if your code is working, I need to know that those two things match. And because you've obfuscated what's going on, it's harder for me to look, as a human, to look at your code and understand whether it works or not. Python literally doesn't care. It's effortless for Python to look at either one of these programs and sees no difference between them, but a fellow human being sees them very differently. There are a number of reserved words in Python. We just sort of avoid these as variable names. They're the keywords like if and while and break and those things. Assignment statements often get people with mathematical backgrounds confused because the key to an assignment statement is that there is a direction to the assignment statement. X equals 1 says, create the variable x, allocate it if necessary, and stick the value 1 into it. So assignment statements have a direction. The right-hand side is an expression. It's evaluated before the assignment statement is done, so Python turns this into a 5, and then after it's calculated it sticks it into spam. You can have variables in the right-hand side. The right-hand side is fully evaluated, so this will become 1 plus 1 or 2, and then 2 will be plugged into spam. It's why you can say something like x equals x plus 1, because the right-hand side is evaluated. In this case, x is a 1, and the sum will be 2. The right-hand side is evaluated before it is actually assigned. Another way of saying this is that the plus operator has higher precedence than the equals operator, which means that Python will evaluate all the pluses in an expression before it will evaluate the equals in the expression. So it ensures that the equal is done last, after all the pluses and the minuses and the divides and whatever is done over on this side. So if we think of this x equals x plus 1, this is what usually math majors get lost when they see. Let's say x has the value 5. Then we can use the same variable before, we can use the same variable on the left and the right-hand side because the right-hand side is done first. So we can see the first thing it does is combines the x old value for x, which is 5, plus 1 equals 6, and then it replaces it in a separate step. And that's because the plus has higher precedence than the equal sign. So the plus happens first. The equal sign happens last. So folks in SI 502, ignore this next part about the input statement. This is an oversimplified view of input that actually does both conversion and reading and conversion. We use raw input in SI 502. And in SI 502, raw input has its own set of challenges. Input seems more convenient, but it has a different set of challenges. It's not as simple as you might imagine. There's all kinds of nasty, scary things you can do to input. You can actually break Python code. That input has been removed from Python 3000. So, but for quick and dirty stuff, input actually is more convenient because it will convert something into a number. Problem is, if you want to input a string, you got to put it in quotes. So input is rather less than perfect. But if you're just inputting a number, and so input is a quick and dirty way in Python to get a number in. And this is not a string like raw input. Raw input gets you strings. Constants or literals are, you know, strings and numbers, and true and false and none are constants. It's not a variable. That's why we call them constants. Literal is probably a better word for it. String data is common. Python has great support for working with strings. For example, we could redo our program doing guessing using string variables. So instead of printing these things out, we could simply put the right answer, the right message we want to send into a variable called message, and then we print the message out. So this is a string variable rather than just printing it at that point in time. So let's dig in a little bit to this notion of how we get that 25. And we'll see this in the next couple of lectures, and we'll dig into it more and more and more. So I'm still not going to show you all of it, but one of the things that happens when you type something into a form, the form has a variable name, and the data that's sent on the request response, the request, has name equals 25. Okay? So in this case, if you were to watch the traffic between the browser and the server, one part of that traffic would be guess equals 25. So one of the problems that we got to solve in reading data from forms is parsing strings of the form guess equals 25. So let's take a look at that. So we're getting a string that says guess equals 25 as a string, and we need an integer guess value. So how are we going to get from here to here? So in Python, strings like guess equals 25 is a sequence of characters starting at 0. So the first character is the 0th character, the second character is the 1th character, and again, it's sort of like European in its thinking. And so G is the 0th character and 1 is the first character. Okay? So that's indexing strings, and we use the square bracket operator as our way of pulling out a piece of a string. So, another operation is slicing, where we can have a subset of the string where I have a starting point, position 2, which is the E, up to but not including position 4, which is the S. And so 2 to 4 is ES, 2 up to but not including 5 is ESS. So that's slicing. So we have the ability to pull a single character out, we have a range of characters, and now we're going to, you can omit the first or the last number, and it picks the beginning and end of string respectively. So that's the beginning up to not including 5, 6 to the end. Now, I keep wanting this next slide to come up. The find slide, I keep hoping. So continuing review, concatenating things together is with plus signs. Plus does not add a space, so we have to add our own space. Now we get to the one I wanted to see. This was a slide I thought was coming. Find operator. So the problem that we're going to solve next is we've got a string coming from a browser that is GUESS equal 25. Literally, it looks exactly like this. If you watch the packets go by, that's what you would see. So we want this 25, right? We want to find the 25. So the trick we can do is we can go look for the equal sign and then go one past the equal sign to the end of the string, and then we'll get our 25. And then we can convert that to an integer. So we start with the find operation. So if text equals guess equals 25, we can say text.find equal sign, and that will tell us what position the equal sign is in the string. And that's position 5. Find, if it doesn't find something, will give us a negative 1. So negative 1 is an indication that we didn't find the string. But if it's there, it will tell us the position that it found it. So recall that our goal is to take the text after the 25, after the equal sign, to the end. Yeah. Stop me if you have questions. It will find the first one. And then you kind of have to you can tell find to start later if you want. So if you find the first one, and then you move up one and say, find me the next equal sign, then you can move up another, say, find me the next equal sign. Find has an optional second parameter, which is where to start looking. So there's a whole bunch of other stuff in the Python string library. We won't use too much of it. We might use some of this stripping and if white space comes in, but we won't probably use much of that. We use a lot more in SI 502. We can convert. So guess equals 25 is of type string. We can see if we get this position back, that would be an integer. And so it's just an integer number. We can ask Python what the type of a variable is, string or integer or whatever. So Python very much understands the nature of variables and enforces it. So if we are adding two strings together, it's happy to do that. It treats that as concatenation. So this ends up with it being the string ABCDEF. If it's two integers, it simply adds them, summing them together, gives us 42. But if we try to add a string and an integer, then it complains and says, I see one of these as a string, so I'm expecting to do a concatenation, and I refuse to concatenate with an integer. Now, it could convert this to a string if it felt like it, but for now, it would prefer to just complain to us and tell us that we have to convert it to a string. And that's what it's doing with a traceback. And so it kills your program at that point. So we can convert integers to strings and strings to integers. So if we want to concatenate this stuff together, we just say str sub 6, our str, they use the function str and pass it a parameter of 6, and that converts our string to the string 6. And so now we can concatenate ABC and 6 successfully. So now let's go back to our problem of taking the key value string, where it says guess equals 25 is what's coming through our browser. We find the position of the equal sign. That's the position of the equal sign. So this is going to be 5. Then we are going to pull out a substring from this. Now, sub is just a variable name. We are going to use string slicing to go position plus 1. Conveniently, that starts us at 6. And then we say we're going to go to the end of the line. So that gets us 6 to the end of the line. And then we're going to take that little slice of the string and put it in the variable sub. Then we print sub. And sub is exactly what we are trying to get. It's everything after the equal sign, and it's 2.5. But we got to be careful, because it's, if we look at the type of sub, it's still a string. So we have to first convert it to an integer to get the number 25, so we can actually do calculations with it. So we use the int built-in function, pass it the string 2.5, and get back an integer value, which when printed looks exactly the same thing. It's still 25. This is the string 2.5, this is the number 25. You really can't tell the difference just by looking at these two, but if you ask for the type of it, you see that eval is an int and sub was a string. So that's the steps of taking a string, parsing the string, and pulling out this little bit. Now, different strings that you want to parse, you look for an at sign or look for a space or look for the second space. I mean, it's not just this pattern, but the pattern of kind of using find to find a position and then using slicing to extract a piece is a very common technique in Python. And it's very common, yeah, very common technique in programming in general. Yeah. No. POS plus 1 does not equal, it either equals neither 25 nor 2. POS ends up being 5 because that is the position of the equal sign. And then POS plus 1 becomes 6.
Right, but 6 is 2, not 25.
Oh, okay. So that's because I don't put a number here. That says keep going all the way to the end of the string. Yeah. You're saying why was it? Yeah, okay. I thought you said why wasn't POS 2, but why wasn't sub 2? That was the question you were asking. Why isn't sub 2? And that's because I left this empty and it went and got the 5. And it, literally, if there was 50 other characters, it would get them all. But it just goes from that position to the end of the string.
So how would you end that? If you wanted to only get the 2, would you just put?
Well, then I would probably put POS plus 2 right there. Well, POS plus 1 to POS plus 2. Yeah, that would work. I mean, I could tell it to just get the 2 if I wanted. Or I could make it be like this. Bracket, POS, plus 1. Close bracket with no colon, and then it would get a single character. Someday Apple will make it so I can draw on this screen, but it'll cost me $2,000 more in the year 2015. For now, I have to draw crappy. Okay. So that's the first 3 weeks of SI 502 in...